In Lower Burma, I was hated by large numbers of people. The only time in my life that I have been important enough for this to happen. One day, something gave me a better glimpse than I had. To the real nature of imperialism, early one morning, at a police station, on the phone, said that an elephant was ravaging the bazaar.
Would you please come and do something about it?
I did not know what I can do, but I wanted to see what was happening.
In Shooting an Elephant, George Orwell explores irony and imperialism in a first-person account of dealing with contrary narratives that germinate upon cultural collisions. The initial narrative style is a goose chase of characters and emotions. The narrative changes once the elephant gun is called for. This is viewed as the point of no return for the imperial officer. His place in the drama is juxtaposed to the crowd, as he represents the crown and in his ethnic differences from the occupied peoples. A famous politician once said, "The first casualty of when war comes is truth." If Orwell is credited as a journalistic watchdog of Western society, how is this bias important to interpreting journalism as a medium? If Orwellian text is cited as moral authority as well as a literary one, Orwell and a large crowd find them the elephant, and Orwell, as the imperial officer, thinks to himself, "I did not want to shoot the elephant." At this point, Orwell ironically switches the narrative and navigates the razor's edge of news and fake news. The execution and languished death of the elephant serve as a metaphor for the death throes of the British imperialism and is underscored by the vibrata of manifest irony.
The sneering faces of young men that met me everywhere. The insults hooted after me. Buddhist priests were the worst. Nothing to do except stand on the street corners and jeer. Secretly, of course. I was all for the Burmese and all against their oppressors, the British. As for the job, I hated it. You see all the dirty work of the empire. All of these oppressed me with guilt. With one part of my mind, I thought of the British as tyranny. Other part, the greatest joy. To drive a bayonet through a Buddhist's guts. The elephant had already destroyed somebody's bamboo hut, killed a cow, and raided some fruit stalls. Constables were waiting for me in the quarter where the elephant had been seen. It was a very poor quarter, a labyrinth of squabbled bamboo huts. I remember that it was a cloudy, stuffy morning, beginning of the rains. We had begun questioning people.
Orwell is one of a long line of the British art of propaganda that traces its roots back to John Dee in the 15th century. Orwell, a master of ironic form and the grandfather of mimetic literature, ironic form theory supports the aesthetic structures of Orwellian writing and empowers his ideas. Irony, as dissected and discussed in depth by critical resources, form curvilinear circuits of narrative that Orwell assembled. Nothing is given to chance, as each irony is enforced by ringlets of meaning and context.
We heard yells.
"Go away, child! Go away this instant!"
An old woman came round the corner of a hut, violently shooing away the crowd of children. Some more woman followed, exclaiming,
"Ah!"
I rounded the hut and saw a man's dead body sprawling in the mud. He was an Indian, almost naked, and he could not have been dead many minutes. The people said that the elephant had come suddenly upon him, with its trunk, put its foot on his back, and ground him into the earth. This was the rainy season, and the ground was soft, and his face had scored the trench a foot deep and a couple of yards long. He was lying on his belly with his arms crucified and his head sharply twisted to one side. His face was coated with mud, the eyes wide open, the teeth bared and grinning with an expression of unendurable agony. Never tell me by the way, that the dead looks peaceful. Most of the corpses I have seen look devilish. The friction of the great beast's foot had stripped the skin from his back as neatly as one skins a rabbit. As soon as I saw the dead man, I said...
Professor D. Tedlock was a college professor at the time he wrote and published his materials about the intended audience of Orwell's Shooting an Elephant. In his perspective, the intended audience is Orwell's own cohort, the bourgeois that he himself is derived from. Orwell's feelings that the imperial mission has failed is extolled through the story, beginning of the story. To Tedlock, the disdain of the officer holds for the imperialism, and the rage he feels towards the Burmese places him in between the proverbial rock and a hard place. By addressing the emotional toll that the imperial life has placed on the officer, could only possibly be understood by another who was befitted from the imperial lifestyle. This point of contention is the key idea in Tedlock's teaching instruction on the subject. His point of contention is that modern textbooks disagree the relative circumstances that prompted the author to write the material in the first place. This ideological view is interpreted juxtaposed the modern critical literary idea brought forth in La Mort de l'Auteur, The Death of the Author. For Tedlock, the idea is separating Orwell and the anti-fascist movement removes an aesthetic cornerstone of the story. The subtext of the title and the unmentionable problem of imperialism, namely the so-called successes of the ism, cannot be understood without the brief and meaningful life Orwell lent to his material. The address to imperialistic bourgeois mends the story in a way that the simple verbiage of the story could not. For Tedlock, the subsequent generations of imperials that would supplant the British imperial rule would do so without the gravitas of Orwell's imperialism, resulting in franchise versions of oppressors that would lack the iconic ambiguity.
The elephant was in the paddy fields below, only a few hundred yards away. As I started forward, practically the whole population followed me. I had no intention of shooting an elephant. I had merely sent for the rifle to defend myself. And it is always endearing to have a crowd following you. I marched down the hill, looking and feeling a fool, with a rifle over my shoulder and an ever-growing army of people jostling at my heels. At the bottom, a miry waste of paddy fields, 1,000 yards across, not yet plowed, but soggy from the first rains and dotted with coarse grass. The elephant was standing 8 yards from the road, his left side towards us. He took not the slightest notice of the crowd's approach. He was tearing up bunches of grass, beating them against his knees to clean them and stuffing them in his mouth. As soon as I saw the elephant, I knew with perfect certainty that I ought not to shoot him. At the distance, peacefully eating, I thought then, he would merely wander harmlessly until the mahout came and caught him. Moreover, I did not in the least want to shoot him. But at the moment I glanced round at the crowd that had followed me. It was an immense crowd, with 2,000 at the least and growing every minute. And suddenly I realized that I should have to shoot the elephant after all. The people expected it of me, and I had got to do it. I can feel their 2,000 wills pressing me forward, irresistibly. To come all that way, rifle in hand, with 2,000 people marching at my heels, then to trail feebly away, having done nothing, the crowd would laugh at me. And my whole life, every white man's life in the East, was one long struggle not to be laughed at. But I did not want to shoot the elephant. I watched him, with the preoccupied, grandmotherly air that elephants have. It seemed to me that it would be murder. The sole thought in my mind was that if anything went wrong, those 2,000 Burmans would see me, reduced to a grinning corpse. And if that happened, it was quite probable that some of them would laugh. The crowd grew very still.
Kaufner's irony, interpretive form, and the theory of meaning support and explain many of the reasons and liberties that Orwell applies to his text. Throughout the story, irony is invoked to create subtext and meaning for all the action, thought, and emotion of the character and locations. To many, including Kaufner, irony is more than a coincidence or sarcasm, since irony can exist independent of those qualities, but not vice versa. Ironic form is the mechanism of abstractly studying irony as a meaning for, as a meaning-creating force in narrative and in human life. Simple irony is examined and explained opposite the trope of literary irony and ironic form. It is through an understanding of ironic form via Kaufner that the generational product of imperialism and officers, nonetheless, shooting the mad elephant while it grazes in the field, become the tragic play of symbolism and subjective experience that can only be weighed against the change in context when viewed via ironic form. Kaufner's credibility on the subject is valuable and enriches the subject with his unique perspective and research emphasis. For him, the understanding of ironic form isn't regulated to the snarky idiom of median comedic or tragic trope. Irony is measured as real or tangible as a tidal force and current in the ocean. A comprehension of undertow changes how one approaches their safety in a body of water. An understanding of Kaufner's ironic form assists the reader to better understand the currents and hidden dangers of the literary body as well. Kaufner's ironic form served to structure the entirety of Orwell's Shooting an Elephant, from its title to the last line, and creates a myriad of subtext and symbolism that wouldn't exist without a knowledge of ironic form and its architecture.
When I pulled the trigger, I did not hear the bang or feel the kick, but I heard the devilish roar of glee that went up from the crowd. In that instant, a mysterious, terrible change had come over the elephant. Every line in his body has altered. He looks suddenly stricken, shrunken, and immensely old. An enormous senility seemed to have settled upon him. One could have imagined him thousands of years old. I fired again into the same spot. At the second shot, he did not collapse, but climbed with desperate slowness to his feet, and stood weakly upright, with his legs sagging and head drooping. I fired a third time. It jolted his whole body and knocked the last remnant of strength from his legs. But in falling, he seemed for a moment to rise, for his hind legs collapsed beneath him, so he seemed to tower upward like a huge rock toppling. His trunk reaching skywards like a tree seemed to shake the ground even where I lay. He trumpeted for the first and only time, and then down he came, his belly towards me with a crash. I got up, and the Burmans were already racing past me. He was not dead. He was breathing very rhythmically, with long, rattling gasp. His great mound of a sign painfully rising and falling. I fired my two remaining shots, where I thought his heart must be. The thick blood welled out of him like red velvet. The tortured breathing continued without a pause. He was dying, very slowly and in great agony. But in some world remote from me, where not even a bullet could damage him further, I felt that I had to put an end to that dreadful noise. It seemed dreadful to see the great beast lying there, powerless to move, but yet powerless to die, and not even able to finish him. The tortured gasp continued as steadily as the ticking of a clock. In the end, I could not stand it any longer and went away. I heard later that it took half an hour to die. Burmans were bringing da and baskets even before I left. Afterwards, there was endless discussion about the shooting of the elephant. I was very glad that the man had been killed. It put me legally in the right. I often wondered whether any of the others grasped that I had only done it solely to avoid looking a fool.
David Chapman wrote a comment on teaching arguments and rhetoric of Orwell's Politics and the English Language to serve as a guide for his readers to better understand what Orwell felt. Quote, Orwell served notice to the all English-speaking people socialists, academics, communists, patriots, clergy, literati, that the language must be used with integrity. Orwell understood language to be more than the sounds generated by humans in an attempt to reach socio-political conclusions. Orwell, according to Chapman, understood language to be something that requires integrity to fully manifest the power of language as a tool for humanity. Chapman argues for the artistic merit of Orwellian journalism and forgives what others might address as bias. To Chapman, Orwell was a champion of impartial journalism and cites that despite being a socialist, Orwell was constantly at odds with English socialism, going as far as to cartoon them into InSoc in 1984, arguing against the idea that Orwell made a practice of argumentum ad populum, which relies on fallacy to win popular support for ideological argument. Chapman cites that Orwell made many arguments that at the time were considered completely antisocial and viewed as anti-Western, as much as his writing was greeted as anti-communist and anti-Stalin. Much of what Orwell proposed as the morality of his writing in anti-authoritarian guises and forms. Orwell made an enemy of power wherever he went. The bias of the masses against Orwell, according to Chapman, stem from the basis of the reader and their conscious or unconscious perspective towards economics and society. Orwell, via Chapman, upheld an integrity in speech that bordered on the near dogmatic and resulted in a human truth on par with gospel.